and welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and my guest today is Alexander Weinstein. His fiction has appeared in Notre Dame Review, Pleiades, Southern Indiana Review, and other journals. His stories have been nominated for Pushcart Prizes and appear in the anthologies 2013 News Stories from the Midwest and the 2014 and 15 Lasco Prize Stories. Today we'll be talking about his debut collection, Children of the New World, which is published by Picador. In the title story, Children of the New World, we have a couple who are mourning the loss of their children. Their children were in the New World, not the Western Hemisphere, but an online virtual reality simulation, which is kind of similar to the program Second Life, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. That's what it was, where it came from, that story.
So many of these stories have what I was thinking of. I came up with a term, I don't know how you'll react to it, but an alienating factor.
Yeah, for sure.
In which we start off the story, we then encounter this alienating factor, something that isn't of our time or our experience, and it casts all that came before in a new light when we hit that point. And so when we find out these kids were not flesh and blood,
yeah,
we have to rethink what's going on here.
Yeah, those are the twists in the story, these kind of moments where everything goes awry, or that suddenly the emotions that we have, that we expect to have for children, in this case of this story, are thwarted somehow. And I think we still feel for them. I still feel for those kids quite a bit, even though as the programmer or the assistant says, they're just data. So why feel for them, right? But we put these emotions onto these technological creatures.
But we feel for characters in books, in movies, television commercials for long distance back when we were younger. So I can tear up at an AT&T commercial. So why can't I tear up over some lost children in the virtual world?
I think, you know, it occurred to me after I wrote the story that part of why it's so problematic that we tear up for these kids are that they're ultimately adware in some way. They're trying to sell the parents. Like, if I extrapolate on this story, they're probably asking the parents for online things that they want, online bicycles and online ice cream cones and what have you. And in the case of Second Life, which it's based off of, that actually costs real money, right? And so these relationships become, I mean, as you're saying, an AT&T commercial does the same thing in many ways. Advertising is trying to bring us in and get our emotions hooked and then sell us something in its most insidious form. And so that's where, for me, even as the writer, while I'm getting connected to these children, I also feel like I'm being sold out into this new world of technology.
What was it? Freud's nephew? Was it Bernays? Was that his name? Who was like the father of public relations?
Huh.
Just it's identifying the need and making the customer insecure,
yeah,
and that they need to fill this need.
Yeah, and that's what, I mean, so many of the stories deal with that insecurity. And I think also our lives online now, there's this kind of insecurity that we, or a isolation or a loneliness that often these games that we're playing, whether it be crushing candy or finding Pokemon or whatever it is, that to some degree there's this fear of, oh my God, please don't let me be alone for more than 30 seconds, right? At a diner or a coffee shop, I find this too, that sitting alone has become an alienating thing. It used to be that you could just sit alone. You could look poetic even. You'd look out the window at the falling rain. But now everybody's on their phones, and it increases this feeling of, you know, I'm not hip enough, or I'm not doing something. I should be doing something in this moment, maybe checking my email for the 80th time today or whatever it is.
Well, there's like a serotonin gift you get when you check your email. It's like they've done studies in where, bam, you get a little hit of something when you check your social media, your email accounts.
Yeah, and they're great with that. I mean, it works that way. And that's the problem, I think, which I think we're all starting to become aware of this. At least I am. Recently, even more so, that there's an addiction or an addictive quality to how we use our technology. When I find myself checking my phone for the 30th time within who knows how many hours, something's off. Or if I'm at a red light and I say, well, maybe I could just check my email for a minute. I have a free second here. That is usually how people smoke cigarettes, for example, or something like that. So, yeah, I think the serotonin, I think they figured us out. And now the question is, can we break the habit that they've cultivated in us?
Well, and that's one of the basic precepts of being human, is understanding we have a nature.
Mm-hmm.
And then how do we identify things that we want to be different from nature, and how do we achieve those things?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fascinating. That, to some degree, I think is playing out in these characters who are trying to remember what it was like to be human or to break out. In the case of the Children of the New World, part of what causes the problem for those parents is that they go to the Dark City, which is this sort of sex city online. And really all they're trying to do is reconnect with their own intimacy and their romance and have that come alive again and break out of the boxes they've put themselves in. And yet it becomes a very dangerous place for them to have ventured out to without protection, so to speak.
When I was reading the story, The Cartographers, and there's a little bit of echoes of Philip K. Dick's story, We Can Remember It For You Wholesale, in that in which you can buy memories to be implanted in your head. And this phrase got stuck in my head, vicarious anomie, in which the breakdown of societal norms happens online in these virtual spaces, and that there's been kind of a loss of conflict in the real world. And so it comes back around because it's something in our psyches requires conflict to be there.
Yeah. That's interesting because in many ways, when I think about at least the political realms and the ecological and social realms of our real world, we have so many problems. There's plenty to worry about and look at. Right now, I've been following the North Dakota pipeline
yeah.
and what the police and the U.S. government are doing to the Indians right now, which has been time immemorial. It's been going on, this sort of war against the natives. And so that's huge. What they're fighting against is ecological, is our water. You got fracking, you've got police shooting black people all over the U.S. There's so many problems. You've got Trump running for president. I mean, there's enough to be concerned about. And so while that story doesn't really deal with that, right, in many ways, these characters are doing fine. They've created this business where they sell memories and they're making a lot of money off of it. But then the problems become this sort of satisfaction, as you're talking about. How do we, as Quimbley says, the evil character in that story, he says, you know, we have to make people almost happy. So they just want a little bit more, right? And he's creating all those bad memories for people, like the heroin addiction for the punk rock musicians and these kind of things.
Well, and I remember in the 90s, there was a hardcore band called Hatebreed, and they had an album title called Satisfaction is the Death of Desire.
Huh. So I'm Buddhist, ultimately, in my thinking. I'm not really an official Buddhist, but I really like Buddhism a lot. And so this notion of ending desire or trying to get through that, or that desire is what leads to suffering, is very interesting for me. And I think in many ways, many of my characters haven't yet gotten to that place. Of course, in the story Moksha, you've got this character that's trying to find enlightenment and finds it because of this electronic enlightenment, but then finds that it doesn't last, right? The next day you have to deal with reality again. And so that notion of suffering and desire is always playing out in my subconscious and I think in my stories as well.
In reading that story, I'd written in the margins something along the lines of being habituated to stimuli is a big part of being a human, and that we could even become habituated to transcendence.
Yeah. Yeah, we see that now. There are businesses popping up, and these are known as yoga studios and tai chi clinics and ayahuasca, you know, ceremonies and shamanic retreats and what have you, that makes a lot of money off of a kind of spiritual materialism. I'm a big fan of yoga, and yet I can see it when you go to these yoga classes where there are dance mixes playing and people are rolling out their $80 bamboo mats and
Lululemon,
the whole thing. It's so the opposite of its roots in many ways, and yet it cultivates once again this materialism or this addiction to commodities, which goes against the philosophy. So I play with that in that story a lot. That story is really all about that kind of spiritual materialism.
Well, and you talk about essentially reincarnation of souls being commercialized.
Yeah, right. That's the pyramid story where we go to war against the Buddhists because of it, because the Dalai Lama has come out and said, this is horrible what you're doing, right? And the U.S. government doesn't really see anything wrong in taking those souls, holding them in crystals, and then removing any undesirable elements from consciousness. That's a horror story, right? Because George W. Bush is reincarnated, I think, 10 times there and is president forever, seemingly, because of a loophole, I suppose, about reincarnation. I play with that stuff a lot. I mean, I'm very interested in many ways, is there a spiritual battle going on out there to some degree? And we were talking about the Dakota Pipeline and this attack on natives and indigenous cultures worldwide. And in many ways, I look at that and I think, you know, these are keepers of a certain lineage of wisdom that often goes against U.S. interests, corporate interests, industrial interests. And that war, that sort of spiritual war, informed that story where, in one of the most absurd turn of events, we're going to war with Buddhists of all people.
But it also points out to a bit of a disconnect in that these cultures aren't perfect and our culture isn't perfect.
Yeah.
And both of us, we have to learn how to, at some point, exist with each other.
Very
and
much so.
Accept that they're not going to see our way 100% both ways.
Yeah. That's what I hope comes through in many of these stories. While there's certainly plenty of darkness happening in these dystopic worlds, the hope is to say that humanity can come together, right? And what we've lost or what we're losing when we connect so much through technology is the communal connections that we have in real life. And that's what I'm hoping we will continue to build. You know, last night I was doing the Thacker Mountain radio show and seeing all these people that came, 100, you know, plus people are in the audience having a great time. I think we want those kind of experiences again, and they're becoming more rare, or they have over the last years because of our online communities, big quotes around communities.
These alienating factors, are these kind of the genesis for the stories, or do you actually see the characters before you come up with the high concept?
It really depends. Each story is very different. So, for example, openness, wherein there's that technology that's a kind of psychic layering where we can put different memories on different layers and then let people in depending on how comfortable we are with them. That technology came to me 2 years before I was able to write the story. So I had this technology, I thought, wow, that's really interesting. Nowhere to land it. And then I was going through a romantic relationship wherein there were these walls, you know, it was hitting the end of the relationship, unfortunately, and the walls were coming up, and I was feeling the way that these layers, we can block people out with our own emotional layers, and suddenly it all clicked, right? So in that case, I think it always needs the human element. Now, other times, like in Fall Line, that just came from watching somebody working at a ski resort doing bar and cooking burgers, and I thought, what's that guy's story? And then I sort of worked backwards to find the contact lenses that are constantly filming everything we do and the rest of the technology there.
With Fall Line, there are several kind of climactic catastrophes that are beyond like technological alienations. We have these alienations from our climate, and you have drought, you have excessive rain, you have global warming, and you have ice ages. So you covered all your bases when it comes to what the global climate could do to us.
I did. Yeah, it's all over the place in that way. We are seeing these things, right? We see drought. We see, again, you know, I mentioned fracking, where we have flammable drinking water. There's no flammable drinking water in any of these stories yet. It's a little too dystopian for people to believe, right? But yeah, I'm very interested in and concerned about where our environment is and how are we taking care of the earth, which again is one of the things that draws me so much to Native American and indigenous cultures, is that many of their ceremonies are around some sort of restoration or taking care of the earth, whereas in many ways a lot of our public ceremonies often don't take care of the earth, right? After a football game, you look around and everything, you see trash everywhere and all this kind of stuff. And this is our ceremony, our weekend ceremonies that we have. So this is concerning to me, how little we often pay attention to the earth itself.
Echoing back to the commodification theme, I remember recently when the CEO of Nestle Corporation said that clean drinking water was not a human right.
That's right. I forgot about that. It's so horrific, right? I mean, that could be out of my story, that somebody just makes that sort of blasé statement. Yeah, you know, drinking water, maybe you need to pay for that to actually have that. That's a privilege. Yeah, when will they say that about air, I wonder? Or in the case of Heartland, where people are selling off their topsoil because that's a commodity. I think this is, in many ways, what I'm pointing out in these stories and sort of going to war with, is this commodification of our humanity or of our basic necessities like water, like air, like land, like the ability to live and have good food available. All of these things are, unfortunately, up for grabs right now, and I'm not quite sure how we got to that state. And when I think about it, it really has been a long process to get to this place where somebody like, you know, CEO of Nestle can say something like that.
Well, I guess it starts back to the concept of land ownership in the first place.
Yeah.
Why does one person have any more claim to a plot of land than another?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, now we're going back, what is it, Rousseau, who speaks about this? And
the noble savage.
Yeah, all of that kind of stuff. I think that was right about that the moment that somebody said, this land is mine, people should have looked at them and said, you're crazy. What are you talking about? You're taking it from the communal. I understand that as the society gets bigger, we have to figure that out. And I certainly like having my privacy and you can close your door and turn on the television. All that is very nice. But what did we trade off? What did we lose in the process? And what about our neighbors? You know, do we care about the neighbors? Do they care whether or not they can make and they have enough food? I think we need to think about these things and bring that into our consciousness.
It just made me think of the Woody Guthrie song, This Land Is Your Land,
mm-hmm.
and This Land Is My Land.
Yeah.
And that such a great song in the American canon, and to think that Woody Guthrie was vilified for writing such a communistic song.
Totally, right? It's so funny. We have these things in our culture that we forget about. On the other side, it didn't say nothing, right? That side was made for you and me. Yeah, exactly. Thank goodness for Woody Guthrie doing those songs.
Well, and I just always loved that, what he had written on the front of the guitar, this machine kills fascists.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Because force isn't the way to get rid of fascism.
Right. Yeah, I agree.
It's good ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I was thinking about these alienating factors, especially with the story about layers.
Yeah.
Sure, these are kind of projections of where technology might go, but they're just more metaphors about the walls we put up for each other and the things that we're already going through, even without technology.
Very much so. I mean, that story is, you know, I explained the back story about where that came from. And it really was that metaphor that I was playing with in the case of their cartographers. That story came, which is the one with the planted memories or where they make memories. That one came from similarly thinking about relationships and breakups and where you have these memories still of somebody when you walk down the street. If you'd walk there with them, you say, oh, I used to walk here and hold hands here. Or we used to go to this restaurant. And this kind of phantom memories that hang around in our lives, whether it be a love relationship or even parenthood where, you know, children grow up and they move on. And then you remember, oh, yes, they used to be on my shoulders right here. And this kind of beauty and nostalgia to memory was what then led into that technology. So in many of the stories, what I am always trying to work with is this metaphor that the technology is the way that I can get at these deeper metaphors of our own lives. I find that in many ways, that's how I'm able to do a bank shot to get into realism, because I think of these stories as realistic and in the canon of literary realism, even though they have these wild sci-fi ideas playing through them.
And you are part of a trend of literary fiction examining more speculative aspects of human experience. So we've got the George Saunders, Karen Russell, Emily St. John Mandel, who blurbed your book. And I was talking with Karen Russell once, and I said, well, this is all made up. Every bit of fiction is fantasy in the first place.
Yeah, it is. That's what, in many ways, we forget over time, I think, because of all these genres and we split it all up. But it used to not be genres. It used to just be fiction. And whether it was an adventure story about pirates or it was space story or people living their lives in the country, all of this was fiction and it all played in the same territory. Now we split it up into different genres. And when I was teaching in Denmark, I was breaking it down for them, you know, saying, well, you have slipstream, and then that can break off into magical realism or fabulism or speculative. And they looked at me and said, why do you do this in the States? Why do you break it all up? And I said, well, I think we like to compartmentalize things to make for some reason.
Also, I was talking with Karen Russell. I said, they talk about realistic fiction.
Yeah.
And I said, these are squiggles on a surface.
Yeah.
That's what your reality is, a little bit of pigment smeared around in a particular fashion.
And I love her work. All the people you mentioned, I really love what they do. They're big inspirations. Many of the people that play with this reality and the notions of what can a story do and where are the limits of that. One of my favorites was Tom Robbins, but he back in the day, he really blew my mind. I'd been reading a lot of serious Somerset Maugham and Chekhov and Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, all these kind of serious writers, Kafka. Then I read Tom Robbins, and I couldn't believe you were allowed to do that. And so that opened the doors and the floodgates to a lot of other writers for me.
One story that is very unusual is excerpts from the New World Authorized Dictionary.
Yeah.
Which is a series of new entries into a dictionary. So I was thinking about the difference between neologisms and portmanteaus and then just alienating or altering the use of a current word mm-hmm. in there. And that in imagining these series of entries, how were you interacting with the language?
I was taking a dictionary course, actually, which sounds really boring, but it was incredibly political. Who knew how political dictionaries got until I took this course? And then one of the handouts we got was these new words, and it was right around, I suppose, the time of the invasion of Iraq, the second one, and it was all war terminology. And I was reading that and saying, what a strange piece, a document we have, a piece of history here to look at, that this is what that year was all of these terms. And that got me thinking, okay, so what would be these new terms for the future? That let me work with all of these different pieces of this story. And then what was interesting, I mean, I really like formalism a lot. And Michael Martone, I think, is just a brilliant formalist who he wrote the book Michael Martone by Michael Martone, where it's all contributors' notes. And you'd never think it could work, but he does a brilliant job. And so I was thinking, how does a story work when it just becomes these little pieces, right? Are there different ways, and I think there are, different ways that can tell a story that breaks the Freytag pyramid structure, where it doesn't always have to be following a character, it doesn't always have to have a central conflict that then resolves. And that's what I was exploring in this story, of how pieces can stack up to create an effect in many ways.
It reminded me a bit of the findings page in Harper's Magazine, the back page thing where they have sentences vary, but they have scientific findings that go from one to another, but they put them into a paragraph, even though they're not directly connected, and they have this cumulative effect.
Yeah. And poets work with this all the time. Fiction writers feel, at least I certainly feel, a little more limited until you really step out of that box and you decide. And Donald Barthelme is a great example of somebody who completely stepped out of that box and said, here's how we're going to write this story, and you're allowed to do what you want. Italo Calvino is one of my favorites, Borges. These are writers who really experiment with that. And so I don't have a theory yet on how that works, because I don't think we've necessarily taught it or studied it enough in the academy and undergrad and MFA programs of how do you break out of the traditional narrative, and then what are the new rules when you do? What are the expectations for the reader?
And in this story in particular, the way that you integrate the previous definitions into the subsequent definitions create a sense of progress and movement in the story.
Yeah. And then you get a sense also, because there's this background of war that's happening throughout the different definitions. And so that creates a setting and a time period. You've got the rap musician G-Spot in there.
I thought of him as the main character of the piece.
Yeah, he's kind of the main character. What a horrible character. But he influences a lot of the other characters in their speech and how they treat women and things like this, right? You've got the bro dogs at the party talking about the definition of mushing, which I won't go into here. I'll let the listeners read that one. But this sort of horrible landscape of interpersonal treatment, I think, is happening in this story. So there are these themes that repeat and that we follow, but not necessarily plot arcs, I'd say. It's not the same kind of a plot arc in there.
But there is a feeling of movement in the piece.
Yeah.
Going back to that kind of concept of the vicarious anomie and breaking down societal norms online, are we at our worst in the YouTube's comments?
We so are. Yeah, comment sections reveal, I think it was Jaron Lanier who said, it reveals our inner troll, right? Because of the anonymity that can happen in comment sections, it lets people be really petty and really, you know, negative and really show some bad sides, because they can get away with it without having to have a responsibility for what they wrote, right? Or you can have these sort of battles suddenly in these comment sections. So yeah, I would say we're at our worst there. Refraining from that is key. I've ended up sometimes on these Facebook posts where I'll see something by who knows who. It's my friend's uncle, racist or homophobic aunt who has written something on the post. And I've made the mistake, though I can't help myself, of getting into this long response where I don't troll them. I don't, you know, go up and say, well, let me try to engage with you on this subject. And here's my thoughts. And it's about, you know, a small essay that I write that I send back to these random people that I have no clue who are. And I usually get a response of, you know, mind your own business, exclamation mark, frowny face. So I've stopped doing that. But it's hard for me not to try to engage and change the discourse within the comments section because it has a negative discourse usually.
There's a great comic from Randall Monroe. Is it XKCD? I can't remember. It's someone on the internet is wrong.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's such a waste of time to get into all of that. And I've learned really not to. But I often can't help myself if I hear something that somebody says that I just fully disagree with. Even in, you know, regular, I'm just walking along and so I hear somebody say something, I'll usually stop and get into conversation because I want to find out. It's probably also the part of me that teaches social justice and brings into the classroom that through discussion, maybe that's where we can start to find a middle ground or some way where, you know, it's particularly when I hear heinous comments. If somebody's saying, what a lovely day, I'm not about to stop and say, you know, I disagree with you. But if they say, for example, you know, I think Sarah Palin is one of the most intelligent politicians out there, which I heard one time in the faculty room, then I really sat down and said, I'm sorry, you know, I disagree with this, but would you explain why you're saying this?
Well, there's a differentiation between intelligent politician and intelligent person. If she was able to get elected, is that not a hallmark of a certain
point.
Level of intelligence?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that's certainly a good move of manipulation, right? And that's the question that I think we always have to look at. And the stories are always looking at this, is how are we being manipulated and who are the manipulators behind this? And how easily do we allow ourselves to be manipulated? And I think that technology leads us into very knee-jerk reactions, like we're talking about comment sections and quick posts and this, where the level of thought behind, you know, of inquiry in many ways is gone, where somebody will post something that's not true at all. And this is getting more and more complex if you are on Facebook and people are posting all these articles that aren't always true. And then it takes forever to prove that they're not true. And by the time you've proven they're not true, the world has moved on.
What did Goebbels say about the lies?
Well, yeah. But
it's something about the bigger the lie, the easier it is to swallow.
And right.
There's the old one about, you know, the lie gets halfway around the world before the truth can put on its pants.
Yeah, that's the case. We're definitely, and now that is so true with the internet. That's the way it works for us. And so that level, and I find this a lot because I teach millennials and younger students, of getting them to slow down, question the information they're having and really engage in it. That's work. You know, if I assign a 10-page essay, let's say, they often complain that that's really long. You know, that's really, it gets boring. And a lot of them are reading the essay as a PDF while watching Game of Thrones on the, you know, they tell me this. They say, well, yeah, and I wanted to watch something I've already seen so that I could just have it as a murmur in the background while reading a very intense critical essay. That level of slowing down, I think, and thinking things through is harder. And the internet makes it harder because we're used to scrolling very quickly through a long article.
A few years ago on vacation, I didn't say I'm not going to use anything online, but I said I'm not just going to use Google.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to use a search engine to find anything. If I know how to get to something, I can look it up. But if I don't know about something, it's just going to have to be a mystery.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, that's great. I think about that a lot because I was just talking to somebody about that last night where I was saying, you know, back in the day when you didn't have Google and you had a dinner party and you're having a conversation, you can't remember something, a lot of people would be wrong and you would say all these, well, was it this? But it led to really interesting conversation, whereas now you just look it up and you say, no, this is the answer, and then the conversation dies.
Yeah, I know, but facts are in question now,
that's
as
true.
We can see by our political discourse.
Yes, it's true. And that is helpful in that way. But I think in what you're talking about with going, especially traveling, where part of what's so wonderful about traveling is getting lost, right? That you go and you're trying to make it to the restaurant because somebody told you to go there, and lo and behold, you stumble onto a market, and then you have to ask some people, and they're from your hometown too, or they're from somewhere interesting, and they say, well, we know another restaurant, and off you go. And that kind of adventure and spontaneity is definitely cut out when you have the line to follow. And you make it to exactly where you want to go, and you hear everything, you see the sights. But somehow we lose the spontaneity and the improvisation of life in that, which I agree. I love doing that kind of stuff and seeing, okay, you know, now I'm going to get lost and find my way home. That's really fun.
I think the travelotter Paul Theroux said that, I mean, he planned to get lost because that's what were the best part of his books, mm-hmm. were the things that weren't planned.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm working with that now a lot. My second book that I'm working on now is a fictional travel guide, so very different. And so it's got hotels of love and museums of heartbreak, and there's a city of loneliness where you go and everybody's having a great time around you, but nobody will talk to you. And so I'm playing with this sense of cities and museums and different countries and how one gets lost in them and the metaphors that come out of that.
And that just makes me think about how we tend to make these experiences discrete, and we don't see how they're integrative and how they're all a part of a thing, the world.
Yeah, can you say more about that?
Just that, I don't know, we think of mourning, and you have a period of mourning. You kind of see that you have, if whether you sit in Shiva for just a couple of days, or if you have to wear the black dress for a year afterwards, that you know, they're... A lot of the way we deal with those things is to put a definite window on them.
Yeah.
But not really understand about how they affect our life going on from there and how the ramifications just keep spilling out and affect other things. I mean, we can say this is the entertainment district of a town. This is the theater district. Hmm. Well, how can I go see theater in the meatpacking district instead?
Mm-hmm.
And back in the old days, they'd have all the guilds, all the glove makers would be on one alley in London, and all the silversmiths would be in a separate area.
Mm-hmm.
And we have tend to kind of ghettoized experience instead of recognizing that it's, you know, integrative.
Yeah, that's really brilliant. I like that a lot. I think that's very true. There's a great Mayan speaker, Martin Prechtel, who talks about grief and praise, and it's on YouTube as well. One can see his speech, and it's beautiful speech about how does grief and praise work. And he speaks a lot about that in particular, that our society is quite rough on how long can you grieve for, right? Something horrible happens. And this may be a loss, or this may be, a death in the family, or a breakup, or anything. And you're expected to be back on work on Monday and, you know, driving the bus, for example. And there's a way that other communities in the past would create a space wherein that grieving could happen and where you could then come back over time and be taken care of. I don't think we have that as much. I think exactly as you're talking about, we do compartmentalize our abilities to have experience and where our emotions are allowed to be and how far they can reach, which is problematic usually for us as human beings.
On the other hand, you know, saying take sitting Shiva, and we've lost so many of our rituals that kind of give a structure to thing, and that so many times we're just kind of on our own.
Very much so. I was lucky to study with Rabbi Zalman before he died at Naropa when I went there at that university. And I took a class called Rituals for People Healers, wherein he trained us. I mean, he had studied all walks of life and all these different spiritual traditions. And he said, many times people are going to go through events that they have no community for and we have no ceremonies for, like divorce, for example, like child growing up and going off to college. That's a great thing, and we have a graduation party, but there's also a way that the parents are now going to have an empty house and need some sort of ritual, perhaps, to recreate their lives, step into a new part of their lives. And this was how to provide that. He was trying to train us as a community to be able to be those people healers at certain points when we needed that. And I thought, what a brilliant class. It's very true. We need that all the time, many times, right? And one could argue that that's what the internet has become for us. We seek these communities. We seek these rituals through our Facebook posts and our Instagram posts. But it's so fractured that I don't think we realize what we're doing often when we're putting on the filters for these, you know, photos of the drink I had last night or the beach I walked on.
What should the ritual be when our Instagram post gets zero likes?
When it gets zero likes, yes, there should be some kind of mourning, right? We should, like, hold the phone and have a little New Orleans parade for it or something. that's exactly it. I mean, if we dig down into all of this stuff, it's a question of what are we looking for underneath this? Why are we posting this? Are we looking for connection? Are we trying to assuage our loneliness? Are we wanting to share our joy and for somebody else to come into that joy with us. Somehow it has to do with other people, clearly. Otherwise, we would just post it on our computers without sending it anywhere and we'd be happy. So that's the fractured part of it, because I think we do these things and we don't yet question or understand why are we doing all of this. And that's where emotions, where suddenly you feel down because nobody liked this post I just put up about smoothies and what's wrong with my life and I better get it together. That's, for me, the humor in these stumblings that plays out throughout the book, right? I mean, that's where a lot of the humor and jokes come from, are these moments of wanting connection through technology.
And so much of ourself is the accumulation and contextualization of memories.
Mm-hmm.
And now that we live in an age where you can preserve moments, mm-hmm. or well, either where there's still pictures or video,
yeah.
How does that change our conceptions of ourselves?
Yeah, I think it does, because many times we're looking both backwards at all of the scrolling through the past photos we posted and laughing about, you know, look what so-and-so said and all that kind of stuff. Or we're taking a photo in the present moment and figuring out, or we're thinking about, how will this moment look when I post it online, right? I mean, we see that all the time where people are posing and people have learned to smile properly and make kissy lip faces for dating profiles and what have you. And in fact, there's a recent episode of Black Mirror, right? I think the opening one for the new season, where you just see this woman alone smiling into the mirror to get the perfect shot of herself. And it's so real. It's so much like what we're already doing. And that part for me is frightening. There's something about that, that where we're distancing ourselves from the present moment, right? I used to be freaked out when I go to a concert and I'd see people with their phones up recording the concert so that they could post the concert later to show that they were at the concert. That kind of postmodernism is now it's normal, but again, we take all these new technological innovations and then it becomes our new normal. And that's, for me, part of the fun is pointing that out constantly just by tweaking it enough that it's weird.
Well, and I've heard people complain about people taking pictures and photographing at concerts, but, well, your grandma used to take a picture at Christmas or at a family celebration. Grandma, why can't you just enjoy the dinner?
Right, yeah, right. That's the point. And I think that's true. I think there's, you know, in many ways, the simplest one is it's true that that tendency to want to capture the moment and have it is good, and that's a pure intention, one might say, depending on how you feel about photographs. But it's the constant curating of our own personalities through this. So grandma didn't constantly carry around her photo album and show.
Well,
if she did,
she's really proud.
Right, it depends on what level. And she didn't go around to, you know, hopefully grandma didn't go around to strangers, which is part of the anonymity, or, you know, the in order to get followers of the family, right? And perhaps she did, you know, this, but that would have been a form of insanity, I think, of which we're much more comfortable with this kind of solipsistic or narcissistic tendency right now.
Going back to the cartographers and where you said they were making those memories almost perfect.
Yeah.
And I thought it was a really good metaphor for you writers, because you're almost getting there all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, getting where?
To that perfect encapsulation of the idea that was in your head of how do I put this in words? How do I convey this to other people?
Yeah, it's true. It is probably what keeps one writing, or it keeps me writing, is that there's always this next treasure chest somewhere, right? Through the castle or down the cave or at the bottom of the ocean that one is trying to find as a writer. And one of the interesting things that I found later in my writing, because I've been writing since third grade, so I've been writing about 30 years now, is that as I let go of trying to find that treasure chest, right? Like, I know in many ways this is what I want to say, or this is what I want to do. As I let go of the desire to get there, there's all these other treasure chests that suddenly will appear. So this means that letting go of the plot in many ways, letting go of what I'm trying to achieve. Because I found that if I just set out to achieve something and then I achieve it, okay, great, maybe that's good. But it's usually very flat for me. I didn't discover very much about myself. It's like somebody who goes into a date or a conversation, and they know exactly the point they're going to make, and they make it, and they sort of stomp over everything else in the process, that's not that pleasurable, and that person doesn't learn a lot. Right? And as I was writing like that, if I would just set out and prove my plot, big deal. But if I let go of it, all of a sudden the characters started to come alive on the page and tell me other things that I didn't know yet about myself. They often revealed subconscious things that I'd been working with emotionally. And that for me was so much more exciting to suddenly discover, wow, I didn't know this. Here it is on the page. I did that? Amazing, right? But this kind of shock of what the subconscious can do, or the muse, I suppose we think of it in more fairy tale terms.
Robert Olin Butler was recently here, and he's paraphrasing Graham Greene, and he said, good novelists have to have bad memories. Because it's letting go of those details and letting them compost is where your creative ideas will come from.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, I still find that I need an ending to get through a story. Like, it's a little too much like getting lost in the woods, you know, and too lost in the woods with no breadcrumb trail left. So I still create endings for myself whenever I get into the story. If I don't have that end point, even though it may never be that, right? I have a fake endpoint often. And then what will happen is I write the story and suddenly I trip over the real ending. And so I've had to train my inner ear to listen as I'm, especially as I'm getting closer to the end that I thought it's supposed to be, and then see where the real ending is.
Now, back to the Black Mirror thing. A big fan of the show, I started watching straight from the National Anthem when it was on bootleg online.
Yeah.
And it's blown away by that. Watched tons of Charlie Brooker stuff before, his screen wipe and game wipe and all the satirical stuff he used to do on TV and his articles and columns for the Guardian. But this new series I started to watch when it hit Netflix, and it was just so much anxiety. I mean, I couldn't even get through the first episode. It was just made me so anxious.
Yeah, it's that first one is brutal, right? And beautiful in many ways. I mean, I think that one where this woman just wants to, in that world, you're rated on your likability ultimately. And so you're nice to everyone, the baristas, and you're taking pictures and you hope that people will like them. And it's such a perfect metaphor for what we do. I mean, it almost is realism because there's so many people I know, and, you know, self-included sometimes, that, you know, look here, here's the cookie and the coffee. I don't do that. You know, that's too narcissistic. But still, you know, whatever it is that we choose to post on there so that we are liked, tragic, right? And that is that anxiety. There is a great anxiety online of having to keep up with your social media. And I think this gets intensified as you look into the kind of things that I was talking about, where you have these dating apps, and so you have to create profiles for yourself that will be likable. And then in the messaging, too, you have to know how to message, right? I found out recently in text messages that if you put periods and punctuation in, that's no longer – that makes you look really stiff. I didn't know that, right? That you seem kind of stuck up with punctuation. I'm not about to give up my commas and periods. Exclamation marks allowed, I think.
And, well, if you just say okay, you better have a colon and a closed pair in there, you're going to look like a jerk.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's it. So these rules, of which we don't – there's no rule book on it. We just kind of figure it out by misstepping, right, and these sort of hive mind rules that have been created – this causes anxiety, I think, especially if you're of a generation that's not used to this. I mean, in many ways, the older generation just gets to be cut out completely from this hipness that's out there now. And so that's another form of isolation where parents that don't know how to text and can no longer speak with their children, right?
Well, and also this anxiety leads to, I think, a willingness for social control.
How so?
To adhering to these standards.
Yeah.
And you have, oh my God, you're not online. You don't have a Facebook page. You don't have an Instagram. You don't Snapchat. you're not a person.
Yeah, there's truth to that, right? And if you don't Snapchat and put on a dog nose or whatever it is, I mean, this stuff drives me crazy. When I see these things that are happening, I have a friend who was showing me Snapchat, and she really enjoys putting on all these different, you know, filters and noses and stuff. And I was horrified. I definitely did not want a photo of me with a giraffe, whatever, on there. And I couldn't figure out why. And my son is 13 years old, and he's very intuitive and quite sharp. And he said, you know, I think it's because you're adding another mask onto what's already a mask. And I was like, yeah, that's why. So those kind of layers of anxiety and social isolation, I do think is the playground of what we're working with all the time, whether we want to acknowledge it or not. And if you are sharp enough online, you don't have to notice it. You can just like leave everyone else in the jet stream behind you of your digital jet stream, right? But yeah, what about all those people? What about all the people that are not online? Right? And I think, in fact, the coolest things, so to speak, I mean, the places where community is really happening is often not online at all. It's in your community gardens. It's at your farmers markets. It's at your local music, you know, where people are getting together, the dinners that people are throwing and these kind of things.
And also there's this chasing of respectability in whichever social strata you're identifying with. Mm. And I don't know about you, but me growing up, you know, the growing up working class, aspiring to middle class, and trying to put on middle class mores. Because I think there's this great saying about the delta, and that the low-income people and the high-income people share the same lack of morals, but only the middle class truly care about seeming proper.
Yeah, in the book, I think the last story, Ice Age, mm-hmm. really plays with that, right? Because you've got that one guy in the double-decker igloo, Phil, the Paulsons, and they've got all the money, so to speak. I mean, there's no money in this world, but they've got the material goods and their ice wall, right? And then all the poor folks are out in their single igloos. And of course, the main character who's trying to be a peacemaker between the two, he has to remember how to talk to rich people, right? And invite them for drinks. That's right. That's what you do, right? Because the whole world is ice and, you know, it's ridiculous that people are still holding on to these old world values in this very rough new environment. And yet that's how he gets invited in for the cocktail and gets to talk about frequent flyer miles and all these things that have no value anymore. And I think that I am playing constantly with these notions of social economics and socioeconomics and the ways that we separate one another. Certainly Heartland, where that poor family is selling off everything they have in order to stay alive, that's a really rough story, but that's also very true to, you know, that came out, I wrote that during the banking crisis when the banks took away everybody's houses and got away with it. And
yeah, because I noticed there were several stories that had upper and Midwest settings.
Yeah.
And I thought these kind of ecological disasters or these technological shifts kind of mirrored the death of the factory town or the farm industries up there.
It's very true. You see this a lot in the Midwest. There are these stretches of barren. And in many ways also I was thinking about how our streamlined places we can buy stuff, our new malls, which is Amazon, right, or eBay, they eliminate the old strip malls. Not that I was a huge fan of the strip malls, but I didn't know that I still liked them until I saw what it looks like to see the ghost towns out there and to see all the closed shops and then, again, the homes that were taken away. And, you know, in Michigan, you have the water issue in Flint where mm-hmm. this was created directly by our governor. This is, you know, criminal activity by an elected official. Again, he got off the hook somehow. I'm not quite sure why we haven't pushed for prison sentence for somebody that knowingly poisons a whole city. And that's horrific, right? But these are the kind of things that we are seeing happening around. And that's where I say, boy, you know, I couldn't write a story that dystopian as what happened in Flint. That's just too dark. But I do want to point those out because I think that many people are living these realities every day. I mean, we know that. And so how do you start to make some sort of social message in there? And that's tricky to do as a writer because there's a way that you can quickly be standing on a soapbox, right? And having a moral in there or a moral stance can be tricky. And part of it, I think, is always undercutting myself in there and always undercutting the character. Like in Saying Goodbye to Yang, that character, the main character, is very judgy. He has had a lot of judgments. And part of that story is revealing how little he fully understands about humanity. So for me, that's been my trick. Whenever I find myself getting a little too preachy, I say, yeah, but what do you really know, Alex? Like, let's undercut that slightly. Let's complicate this.
Now, this won't air until December.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be after the election.
Yes.
So what would you like to say to President Trump?
Well, you know, there was this, meme somewhere which said, you know, the new reality show should be that we tell Trump that he won the election and then we make a fake White House and we put it in him and then we film everything that he does and all those. Yeah, this has been quite an election season. It's actually been the stupidest election season that I've ever lived through. Like, I've never seen such a disappointing won. I was very excited about Bernie Sanders, right? I mean, I just thought, great, here's a candidate who's saying all the things that I want to hear. Like, let's stand up for the Native Americans. Let's help out people that are suffering and need health care. Let's help out the poor. Let's put students through school and not give them crippling debt. Let's call the banks out for what they've done and hold them responsible, and oil companies. I mean, it was just great. And of course, he didn't get the nomination. So, I mean, now, well, I'll vote for Clinton, and I hope that she proves me wrong, right? Because her ties to fracking and her ties to big money in this way is very disturbing. I don't know why she hasn't said anything about North Dakota pipeline right now.
Anybody in the national news
right?
said anything?
It's crazy. So this is very disappointing, but Bernie Sanders has, right? And there's, you know, I want to shed tears when I see these posts by Bernie Sanders about let's stand up. I'm like, yes, why is he not our candidate? And of course, Trump is so far ridiculous. You know, he's talking about grabbing women by the you know what, and that's apparently part of his, you know, he's not apologizing for that really, and just kind of goes on with his bravado. He's so far off the map for me of ridiculousness. You know, I was thinking as I was driving here, like, that's not even somebody that would say that about women isn't even like good for like the president of the stamp club. You know, I don't want them taking care of the co-op board, nothing, never mind the country. So yeah, it's a bit of a disappointing election in that way. You know, I imagine and I hope that Clinton will win, but I have major reservations about will she come through. And I think one of the things with when I say will she come through, with representing all of the dispossessed and the people that need the most in this country. And I do like a recent Bernie Sanders video where he said, that's up to us. We have to put that pressure on whoever we elect. If we want to see more money for the poor, if we want to see less war, if we want to see et cetera, then it's up to us to really push for that. And that in some ways is inspiring. And also, I think in many ways, we felt very disempowered as a populace because there's this feeling of what voice do we have? I think we have a really big voice. We just haven't used it enough yet.
I think one of the most telling things about Donald Trump's candidacy is that Sheldon Adelson, who's a big casino owner in Las Vegas, and he owns the Las Vegas Review-Journal.
Okay.
Recently, one of the very few publications to endorse Trump for president, fought for years and years to keep Donald Trump from getting a casino gaming license in Las Vegas. He has a hotel, but he can't own a casino because Sheldon Adelson didn't think he was a proper character to own a casino in Las Vegas. But his paper has now endorsed him to lead the entire country.
There you go. Classic. Yeah, it's really absurd. If I was to try to write this story about Trump becoming, you know, running for president and the things he said, it would just be too high satire. The absurdity, you'd say, oh, you're just overdoing it. There's no way. That, for me, has been what's so bizarre. And, of course, a lot of people support, you know, there's enough people out there that are still supporting, even after he comes out and says heinous things about women, about Muslims, about Mexicans, about you name it.
Well, after he said about John McCain, I don't root for losers. I don't root for the people who get captured. I said, if that doesn't sink him,
yeah, right,
can.
Veterans, everything. So I'm not quite sure what people are seeing. Except I think maybe there's the place where we may speak the same language has to do with a distrust of government in this way, where you see, boy, the government really has been doing shady things for a long period of time. And it's been making a lot of deals with corporate enterprise to take people's rights away in different countries, in our own country. I'm thinking also just about, you know, it's dirty energy. And I was reading about Joe Sacco and Chris Hedges wrote this great book about coal mining and the removal of the mountaintops down there and what happens to the communities around there. Our government makes these contracts and helps that out. And right now, apparently, is doing an Indian war once again, right? So these are reasons to distrust or to really question the government's interest. And I guess that's where I can understand that. But that's about as far, you know. At that point, I think we ultimately disagree about how to take care of the poor and the sick and the ailing and those that need in this country.
I was thinking about so much of the vitriol is just so terrible in the election and its language. And I said, how did we get to be so mean? Mm. And I thought about it and I said, we've always been this mean.
Mm-hmm.
You can see pictures of people yelling at black kids wanting to go to school.
Yeah.
And going back to, you know, removal of American Indians.
I know, exactly. And this is what's so heartbreaking for me. I mean, there's a lot of hope in this collection. I think there's a lot of love and, you know, in the acknowledgments, I say thank you to the people that are making this world a better place. Because I think there's so many people that do good work and that try to be good, but it's, I often say, you know, if I wasn't such an optimist, I wouldn't be so cynical, because it is hard to see. You get these things where you really do see human, and I don't think it's human nature per se. I mean, this is the argument, or this is the question, you know, are we born selfish and mean? And certainly when you see a young child saying, I want 10 pieces of cake or whatever,
mine.
But you have to train kids out of that, right? And you have to learn, and I think this is where Buddhism comes in, this learning of the selflessness, this learning of compassion and empathy, of which our great spiritual traditions usually try to help out, you know, this nature in us to help one another, to get over that. And yeah, probably where the blame lies is in creating structures of commerce that make us want more than others, right? That make us think of how do I get ahead, a kind of survival of the fittest capitalism that then influences the way we treat people, the way we want things, the way we collect, you know, and hoard. I play a lot with different levels of dating in there. And I think about Tinder, where you're swiping people away, right? You're swiping people into the garbage because you don't know what they, you don't like what they look like. Well, that is a certain level of lack of compassion for humanity. I mean, obviously you're trying to figure out if you're on one of these apps, you know, who do you connect with? But there's a way that people become expendable. And so I think any technology that makes us more expendable or teaches us in that way is teaching us something that minimizes our compassion and empathy.
When you said you have to train us out of this, every bit of human action is part of our nature. Mm-hmm. And it's just what do we choose? Which wolf do we choose to feed?
Yeah, very much so. That's exactly right. And I think hopefully where we're moving towards, and here's my optimism, we're moving towards a place of much greater empathy and compassion and care for the world. Now, there's so much proof. One could point to all these different places where that's not happening. But I think our struggle, our mission, our job is to work towards that, to constantly try to show care and love and spread more of that in the world. In this book, I'm hoping it does that. I'm hoping that's what the undercurrent always is, even though there's so many lives in here where they're struggling with the alienation of either technology or corporate interest. But underneath it all is, how do you be a good parent? How do you be a good lover? How do you be a good son or daughter and take care of parents? And
these are the same questions we've been asking ourselves for centuries and millennia.
Yeah, right. And we will continue to into the future, I suppose.
Well, Alexander, I want to thank you so much for stopping by today. It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, pleasure too. Thanks so much.
Alexander Weinstein is the author of the short story collection Children of the New World, which is published by Picador. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.